to the fourth case this morning, Ama v. Holder. Ms. Cobb.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Erin Cobb. I am here on behalf of the petitioners, the Rama family. The Ramas are seeking review of their asylum claim, which was denied on the basis of an adverse credibility finding. This court's standard of review in such cases is highly deferential, so long as that conclusion is supported by specific, cogent reasons that bear a legitimate nexus to the finding. This court does not defer if a conclusion is not based upon those reasons or to one that is based upon speculation. This court has commanded that if an IJ does find inconsistencies or finds the applicant incredible, the IJ must look to consider whether the applicant provided a convincing explanation or extrinsic evidence. This court has also commanded that if an IJ does consider that evidence as it most plausibly fits together as a whole, and how that evidence may make a claim more plausible even without specifically corroborating it. In this case, the Ramas provided convincing explanations when they were given the opportunity and also provided extrinsic evidence. However, the IJ failed to consider this evidence as it fits together as a whole and how it made their claim more plausible. I'd first like to go to the kidnapping and rape. The IJ found that this was an inconsistency because it wasn't mentioned in the airport interview, but it was detailed both in the statement that supported the asylum application and in the testimony. So the first thing this court has commanded is that the IJ, once she finds an inconsistency, must then look to whether there is a convincing explanation. We had here the testimony and the statement of an expert, Dr. Fisher, who talked about rape being a very, very serious crime in a patriarchal, conservative Muslim society, that the victim was actually made out to be the guilty one and would be ostracized by her family and by her social circle. The victim would be considered deviant and immoral. We had Natasha, who testified that she was very ashamed of what had happened, that she was frightened that if she would return, people would find out, and something even worse would happen. She also told the judge that she hadn't even told her husband all the details of what had happened at that time of that credible fear interview. We also had Farrick, who, when his attorney started asking him questions about the kidnapping, didn't even want to talk about it. He had to be prodded both by the IJ and his own attorney in order to talk about that kidnapping and that rape. Natasha and Farrick really view, I think, the kidnapping and the rape as one incident, as one thing. We know this because Farrick refusing to talk about both at first. And then Natasha, when she was at the airport interview, she herself shut down any line of inquiry into what might have happened to her.
Let me just stop you for a minute. IJ acknowledged this whole issue of shame and the whole cultural problem with it, but went on to look at other things to find their testimony not credible. For example, the fact that neither she nor Farrick suggested at the airport interview that his membership in the Democratic Party had anything to do with why they were targeted, and this whole business about this nice car, you know, when she was trying to determine if the person worked for the government. There were other things beyond them failing to mention the rape at the interview.
Right. When the IJ kind of acknowledged that the explanations of not mentioning the rape and the kidnapping may be convincing. However, she did say if the multiple rapes were the only admission. To me, this looks like the IJ is taking this convincing explanation and throwing it out simply because there were other omissions. This court, when they look through inconsistencies, they look through them one by one. And if there is a convincing explanation, then it takes, you know, that explanation takes that inconsistency out of that pile and moves it over to, I guess, the non-inconsistent pile. Now, as far as the judge did look to the Democratic Party membership and whether, you know, she found that there was an inconsistency because the leadership wasn't mentioned in the interview. I think we need to look then at the reliability of that asylum interview, whether it was more or less reliable. The credible fear interview. In this court's decision in Balagan, the court has laid out a few standards. One of them is the applicant's frame of mind. Another one is whether the interviewer had asked questions that were designed to elicit the details and asked follow-up questions. I brought up with me Farrick's asylum interview, which is actually 5 pages long. However, there are 4 questions that the interviewer asked Farrick about his fear. That's on 977 and 978 of the record. So that, you know, no one ever asked Farrick if he was the member of an organization, if he was the leader of an organization, if he participated in any way. Farrick did give detailed testimony about the work he did for the party. The IJ did not find that this testimony was vague, that it was evasive in any way, that it was inconsistent, or that it was implausible. Natasha had explained that she wasn't sure how things worked here, that she didn't know the extent of detail that she needed to tell about herself. She was still afraid of being returned, and that when they were returned, people might know what they had divulged here. As far as the car that Your Honor mentioned, I think what we have in the asylum interview is kind of, because they didn't want to talk about the kidnapping and rape, they're conflating multiple events into an event. They're taking out that kidnapping and rape. That first time that the officers came to the house, they did ransack the house. They did threaten Farrick's life. And so we have her pushing this all together. We had Farrick talking about a nice car when the officers first came in. That's how they knew that it was a police vehicle before they recognized any of the officers. Frankly, also, I've searched the record. I could not find a time when the applicants, when either of the Ramas were asked why they didn't identify their persecutors by name in the interview, but they did in the statement and in the testimony. I don't think this is an obvious inconsistency where they should have just naturally said, oh, and by the way, the IJ has a regulatory duty to develop the record, and if she was going to rely on less detail here but more detail in testimony, then she needed to give them the opportunity to explain perhaps why they didn't actually say the name of the persecutor when they did, in fact, know the name, or at least she did learn it later. So I'd like to move then to the IJ's, I guess, looking at corroborating evidence. I could go ahead and stay with Democratic Party membership. She found it was inconsistent because they had offered a letter, they had submitted a letter stating that Farrick was a member of the Democratic Party from 1992 to 1997, but it didn't say that he was a leader of such a party. Again, never in the record was Farrick asked why he didn't get a letter saying leader, or why he didn't get a letter saying the activities he participated in. He was not given the opportunity to explain why the letter said member when he said he was claiming a leader. The IJ says that it was reasonable to expect him to get such a letter, but this is conjecture or speculation. Without asking Farrick about it, we have no idea whether it was reasonable or not. There could be a whole host of reasons why the Democratic Party in his village was only willing to write such a minimal letter. So just the statement that it was reasonable without more is speculation. The IJ did, however, fail to take that letter and consider how it makes all of this more plausible as a whole, how it fits in, a piece of the puzzle, one would say, and makes the story more plausible. Other evidence that she failed to examine in such a light would be the letter by Chicago Health Outreach and by Dr. Martinez. Chicago Health Outreach and the doctor both detailed Natasha's emotional and physical reactions when she was explaining to them what had happened. They talk about her being anxious, about her sobbing uncontrollably and having to compose herself to get going with the story. Chicago Health Outreach diagnosed her with post-traumatic stress disorder, chronic severe, and listed a whole host of other physical and emotional symptoms. The IJ recounted some of these things, but then tossed them aside, saying that they didn't corroborate that specific event. She should have, however, looked at them as pieces of the puzzle. They show that this was more likely, it made it more plausible that this entire event happened. So I see them in my rebuttal. Thank you.
Jones.
May it please the court. Hello and good morning. My name is Tracy Jones, and I'm appearing on behalf of the respondent, Eric H. Holder, Jr. This court should deny the petition for review because substantial evidence supports the adverse credibility finding. First, with respect to the airport interview, today the petitioner's counsel argues that the interview was not reliable. However, there's no evidence in the record of that. According to Belongon v. Ashcroft, this court has held that reliability concerns not only the accuracy or the validity of the documents in which the airport interview are recorded, but also the applicant's frame of mind and also the applicant's ability to answer the questions at the interview. Here, it's clear from the record that the entire transcript from the airport interview is included in the record. They could be found on pages 975 through 978 and 644 through 648 of the administrative record. The questions that were posed to him were clearly understood because they were answered correctly or answered to the best of his knowledge. Furthermore, the applicant only challenges the translations that were provided at this interview. The applicant or the petitioners failed to challenge whether the translations or the actual transcript is inaccurate. Therefore, based on this, the immigration judge was reasonable in relying on this airport interview and assessing the petitioner's credibility. Furthermore, before the interview was even conducted, the asylum officer provided detailed instructions as to why it was important for the petitioners to disclose all the information that of their experiences in Albania and also to provide complete and accurate answers. And the petitioners failed to do so at the airport interview. However, the petitioner's counsel is requesting that we basically not look at the airport interview in assessing a petitioner's credibility. And in Chadha v. Mukasey, this court has upheld an adverse credibility finding where the airport interview contradicted the petitioner's testimony at the merits hearing and also the petitioner's written asylum application, which is clearly the case here. At the airport interview, the petitioners omitted the rape of the female petitioner, who is the lead petitioner in this case. Both her husband and her child are derivatives of her asylum application. The fact that she omitted the rape, which is a material fact for her claim and it's the sole basis for her claim, is detrimental to her claim and to her asylum application. This court has held that material facts being omitted at airport interviews support an adverse credibility finding, and they certainly do here.
Ms. Jones, let me ask you, when they do the airport interview, do the officials separate, in this instance, the husband from the wife? Does she have an opportunity to give her story of what happened?
Yes, Your Honor.
Separately, apart from her husband?
Yes, Your Honor. The airport interview was conducted separately, and Natasha, the female petitioner in this case, had the opportunity to explain exactly what she feared in returning to Albania, and she never disclosed the rape or the kidnapping at that time, even though she was provided the opportunity to do so.
One of the points you make is that she isn't consistent on the exact number of days that she and her daughter were in the hospital.
Yes.
But you don't dispute that there was some support for the fact that they were in the hospital, do you?
Your Honor, she did submit evidence that shows that she was in the hospital. However, the fact that she was unable to provide consistent information and details about this hospitalization supports the immigration judge's adverse credibility
finding. Well, is there any other explanation in the record as to why they were in the hospital?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, she claims that on page 272 of the administrative record, the female petitioner stated that she was hospitalized for 5 days. However, on page 783 of the record, which is the Chicago Health Outreach document that was submitted, it states that she was actually hospitalized for 5 days, which was consistent with her prior statement. However, when approached or when presented with that inconsistency in regards to the another document that she submitted, which stated that she was in the hospital and received treatment for 8 days, the petitioner recanted her previous statement and said that she was in the hospital for 5 days and received outpatient care at her mother's house for 3 days. These statements and documents are also inconsistent with the same document that the petitioner submitted from Irene Martinez, which is allegedly the doctor that she is receiving treatment for her post-traumatic stress disorder, where she stated that she was only hospitalized for 3 days. When confronted with conflicting stories, the immigration judge does not know what to believe, and that upholds an adverse credibility finding, which is clearly the case here. Furthermore, the petitioner also failed to disclose any information about the male petitioner's political involvement in the Democratic Party in Albania. In the opening brief, the petitioners contend that they did not disclose this information because they were unfamiliar with the political process for asylum in the United States. However, at the beginning of the airport interview, the petitioners were clearly instructed to be clear, detailed, and complete in providing information in regards to their alleged persecution in Albania. And even during the interview, the petitioners attempted to elicit answers from the petitioners in regards to why they feared returning. On page 977 of the administrative record, the male petitioner was actually asked, "Why do you fear returning to Albania?" The only information that he provided was information in regards to a car accident that he had been involved in Albania. On page 646 of the administrative record, when the female petitioner was explicitly asked, "Why do you fear returning home?" she also again provided the same reasoning that the male petitioner provided. The fact that the male petitioner was involved in a car accident, and that the people that the owners of the car that he allegedly struck was attempting to extort money from the family. And those were the only reasons that the petitioners provided at the airport interview. And furthermore, the asylum officer also stated or asked if there was any other fear that the female petitioner had if returned to Albania outside of the fear of returning for the extortion reasons. And the female petitioner clearly stated no. Therefore, these omissions are material facts that go to the heart of the claim, because this is the sole basis for their claim. And their failure to disclose these details at the airport interview support the adverse credibility finding. Furthermore, in addition to those inconsistencies, there were also inconsistencies in regards to the injuries that the female petitioner suffered as a result of the rape. The female petitioner states that she received cuts and bruises, and that she had to go to the hospital in addition to other injuries in order to seek treatment. However, the document from the hospital clearly goes through the different injuries that the petitioner suffered and the treatment that she received. However, this document fails to discuss any of the treatments for these scars and bruises that the petitioner alleged she received during the time of the commission of the rape. In addition to that inconsistency, the petitioners also failed to corroborate the male petitioner's political affiliation with the Democratic Party in Albania. As I noted earlier, when the immigration judge does not know what to believe, which is the case here, since the petitioners provided numerous conflicting stories, corroborating evidence or the failure to present corroborating evidence can be fatal to the claim. The male petitioner submitted a document from the Democratic Party in Albania. However, the document failed to disclose his job title, his duties, or even give any inkling as to why the Albanian government would be interested in him. The petitioner stated on numerous occasions that he was an elected leader in the Democratic Party, in the section in which the person who drafted the letter for him or the document for him was actually a leader in. Therefore, the failure for the letter to corroborate his claims that he was an elected official and that was the reasoning for him being persecuted by the Albanian government supports an adverse credibility finding. Therefore, this court, the agency properly concluded that the immigration judge, that the petitioners failed to meet their burden of proof with credible testimony, and petitioners failed to identify any evidence in the record that will compel a contrary conclusion. Therefore, this court should deny the petition for review. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 1 minute, Ms. Cobb.
Thank you. Just a couple of points quickly. As far as the omission of the single instance of harm in the airport interview, the cases that the government has cited for those are Forgi, Xiao, and Corneliu. The court still looked to the explanation, and in those cases, there was no convincing explanation offered for the failure to mention it. Those applicants had said, oh, I was under stress, or oh, I didn't have an attorney. We had a different level of explanation here. If the court indeed did accept that explanation, then why the focus on the hospital letters? The hospital letters then were just a piece of corroborating evidence instead of this, I guess, big deal that the court was making out of it.
Did the hospital letters include reference to rape?
They do not. And again, we look to the explanation in Dr. Fisher's affidavit and statement saying that what a big deal this was in the Albanian society. So why would the doctor create a written record of something that would ostracize his patient? Natasha also stated they didn't ask any questions and she didn't tell him anything about it. As far as the dates, this court has consistently stated that human memory is fallible, that it is in fact liars that tend to remember little details to a great extent, and that human memory itself, both in Cadia and Matondo, this court has said, is sometimes fallible.
And let me ask you more about those medical records.
Sure.
The injuries that were sustained, I mean, was there any identification of the injuries which would corroborate that it was a rape?
There are, if, you know, I had to use WebMD and some other documents to look up some of those terms. There was a mention of hematoma, which is a kind of, you know, bleeding a burst blood vessel. So that could have been, we don't know which kind of hematoma it was. It wasn't any more specific than that. So
yeah,
that could have been.
Where it was located?
Correct. All it says was hematoma, something very general. And then there was another one, I believe it was azotemia, which I also had to look up. There's one kind of azotemia. It's too much urine in the blood. One kind of it is caused by trauma, such as shock. What were the other things they said? Shock, hemorrhaging, cardiac arrest, these kinds of things. So there are things, you know, that could be taken, but it's just not a very detailed letter. So I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under